It is my honor and my pleasure to be with all of you today at our International Yoga Conference in Rishikesh. Thank you for being here. I read the little book of the program just before I came, just to see if there was a subject I was to speak on. And I discovered that I am supposed to speak on my experiences with Himalayan yogis. Is that what you would like me to talk about? I'll try. Have any of you read this book, The Journey Home, that I had written? I never wanted to write that book. For many decades, people would tell me, you should write a book about your travels in search of truth. Because every now and then I would tell some story. And they were really strange stories. I always said no. Because if I write what actually happened, I don't think anybody will believe me. And second of all, to write a whole book about me, with every page saying, I, me, mine, me, isn't that an act of arrogance? But then something happened. It was about 10 years ago. I was with one of my very dearest friends and god brothers. His name was Bhakti Tirtha Swami. He was an African-American who was born in the ghettos of Cleveland at a time in the 1950s and 60s where if you're born in the ghetto, it's a 95% chance that you will live and die in the poverty of a ghetto. The Constitution spoke of civil rights, but the country did not offer civil rights to minorities. But he was incredible, so positive. He never lost hope. He had such faith in God and such a will to do good for others that without even asking, he got a full scholarship to Princeton University. And he graduated. And he was the leader of the civil rights movement at Princeton in the 1960s. That was Martin Luther King's movement. But he had a spiritual calling. And eventually, he became a Swami with the same guru as me, His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. He wrote many books. He would give spiritual guidance to people like Nelson Mandela, Muhammad Ali, Alice Coltrane. He called me to his bedside, because he was suffering from melanoma cancer. And when he called me, he told me the doctors gave him 3 days to live. So I drove perhaps 6 hours to a remote little community in Pennsylvania of the United States. And I spent 3 days with him. The day I was about to leave, because I had a really very, very busy schedule with events that were arranged years before that I had to go to. So I went to say goodbye to him. But before I could say goodbye, he looked up at me with very innocent, childlike eyes. Even though he was a great scholar and a powerful, powerful orator and a leader, like a general of spiritual troops, but he looked up at me with such sweetness and said, "I want to die in your arms. Please stay with me." So I said, "I will stay as long as you live." I was expecting one more day. But he lived another 8 weeks. I'd like to tell you one story. One that is etched so deep forever in my heart. Because his health was going through so many ups and downs. But his consciousness was always so humble, so transcendental, so full of compassion and detachment. This is an irresistible combination, detachment and compassion. Because sometimes to be detached, you're not really compassionate, you really don't care. It's not about me, nothing, no one. So sometimes detachment creates an aloofness. But when there's deep detachment from one's own ego, from one's own selfishness, that's harmonized with profound compassion, real care for others, real willingness to make sacrifice for the welfare of others, that's a combination that can transform people's hearts. So one day he was in so much pain that his whole body was trembling. And they sat him on a chair because he was paralyzed from the waist down. And one of his legs were amputated. So he was just sitting on a chair and I was speaking to him. Because we would spend hours and hours just talking about spiritual subjects. But as I was speaking, I could see he couldn't focus on what I was saying. So I began to chant this Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And as I was chanting, he held my hand. And suddenly, the most blissful smile manifested on his face. His teeth practically went to his ears, it looked like. That's how he was smiling. And his eyes, I never saw him cry when he was in pain, but his eyes were pouring tears of joy. And then he was shaking his head, and he told me, "It doesn't get any better than this." Same pain was there, the body was still trembling. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "It doesn't get any better than this. I would not trade my position for anything or anyone else in the world because I'm tasting the sweetness of Krishna's names." And then he looked at me and his eyes were glistening with light. And he said, I'm feeling Krishna's love, and I know where I'm going, and I'm ready to go. It doesn't get any better than this. One day, as he was laying down, I was sitting at his bedside. He said, "You should write a book about your travels when you were a young boy." And I said, "I will not write this book." And I told him all my reasons. And I really thought they were good reasons. I thought they were enlightened reasons. But he said that it is not your story. It's the story of a young man who is seeking the same goals that everyone is seeking for happiness, for purpose, for fulfillment. Your story can move people's hearts. Therefore, it will be an act of arrogance for you not to write it. And he looked up at me and said, "Promise me on my deathbed that you will write and publish a book on your journey." It wasn't a situation where I could debate with him. And he said, "Promise me." So I didn't really mean it, but I said, "I promise." Then he looked up at me and said, "You cannot break your word to a man on his deathbed." But I had no intention of doing it. I was thinking for the next couple days how I was going to convince him to allow me to withdraw my promise. But before I could do that, he left. Krishna took him away. So in his honor, I wrote this book. In 1970, when I was 19 years old, I had no money. And I was going through an evolving process looking for meaning and purpose in my life. And as I was traveling, I came to certain conclusions that if I really want to make a difference for myself in the world, it has to be spiritual. Do you have a harmonium? Okay, thank you. So, ultimately I hitchhiked from London to India. It took about 6 months. And when I came to India, in New Delhi, there happened to be the first, I think in history, international yoga conference. Okay. There were about 800 yogis and rishis there, and it took several years to organize. A Christian man named Christopher Hill, who was a yogi, he spent so much, all of his money and years trying to make this event. And there I met several Himalayan yogis, Swami Rama, Swami Satchidananda, Jay Krishnamurti, and many, many others. And when the conference ended, I was all alone. I came to Rishikesh. And in 1970, Rishikesh looked very different. There were no restaurants or bakeries or any of these things. And there were not that many ashrams either. It was a very quiet, secluded place. Extremely quiet. There was no sound systems. I went to the Divine Life Mission of Swami Shivananda, and I spent nice time with Swami Chidananda Saraswati, who was then, he just passed away a few years ago. He was the Acharya and president, successor of Swami Shivananda. And then I crossed the Ganga and came just a few minutes' walk from where we are now. It was south of here. And there was nothing around. On one mountain, a distance away, was the place of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. On another side was the Paramarta Niketan, where we are. But then, where I was sitting on the bank of the Ganges was totally quiet and secluded. And looking across the river, I saw there was nothing there except forest. And there would always be a few yogis sitting and meditating. My first day, I sat in meditation and prayer for several hours. And then a holy man wearing robes with long gray beard and hair came out of the forest and was walking in my direction. His robes were flapping in the breeze from Mother Ganga. He walked right up to me. I stood up to greet him. His first words, he said, "You do not know who I am, but I know you. I have been watching you, and I see your determination. Now take off your Western clothes and offer them in Mother Ganga, and I will give you the robes of a sadhu." I asked him, "What is a sadhu?" First time I heard the word. He said, "A sadhu is a homeless wanderer who's seeking spiritual truth." And I was thinking, well, that sounds like what I am. So I had gray jeans and a gray turtleneck shirt with stripes. That was the only set of clothes I had. Because while I was in Afghanistan, in Kabul, someone was chasing after me and I had to run away and I didn't have time to pick up my clothes. When you only have one set of clothes, and you're wearing those clothes for several months, it really becomes a part of your identity. I didn't realize how attached I was to them until I was asked to put them in the river. It was like I was asked to adopt a whole new identity. Isn't it interesting how we become so attached to our identity on the basis of external things? The Gita says, "Vasamsijyanani yatabihaya," that this body is also a set of clothes. It's the Atma, the soul within the body, that's actually wearing these clothes. But according to the set of clothes that we have such a sense of identity. I'm black or white or red or yellow. I'm Eastern or Western. I'm male or female. And we build our whole life around this sense of what we're wearing. So I took off my jeans and placed them. And at that time, the Ganga, she was flowing very strong where I was sitting. Gone forever. Then I took off my shirt. Gone forever. And I was standing there. Now this was in the end of December, so it was very cold. I was standing in my underpants. But he didn't give me the sadhu clothes. He was just holding and looking at me. And, I was hoping he'd give them to me because I had no money to buy any clothes. And he said, give up your underpants. Put them in the Ganga. This was becoming serious. Renunciation. From the Gita's perspective, our outer clothes is like our body and our senses, and our underwear is like our mind. it's like a type of clothes we wear that aren't seen by many people. And I remember thinking, because in those days there was no importing, exporting much in India. I was thinking there's probably not another set of underpants available for 5,000 miles. And he had these two strips, he called it a copan, just two strips of cloth. And he had me tie one around my waist, and then he had me loop up the other one over the other to wrap it around. You know what I mean. And he said, now you have this, give up your Western underpants. So I took them off and said a prayer. Mother Ganga, this is the end of my identity for everything I've known in my life so far. They were gone forever. Then he showed me how to put on the same clothes I'm wearing now, except only the two pieces. A chador around the upper part and a lungi around the lower part. And then he spoke very closely in my ear. The Ganga will become your mother. She will reveal this to you in time. He turned around and walked back into the forest. That was 44 years ago. To this day, I've never seen that man again. But I found a place to sleep just behind the Vaidniketan ashram. It used to just be a one-story, just about 7 or 8 rooms. I found a cave. Now, where my cave was, is some sort of hotel. Things do change in this world. But back away, so it's a very nice little simple cave. And every morning I would go and sit on a rock, the same rock every day, that was near the middle of Mother Ganga. I would kind of walk through up to my waist to get to. And I would sit there from sunrise to sunset and meditate and pray for about a month. It's incredible. When we open our hearts and our minds to receive blessings, grace, knowledge, how God could speak to us in such transformative ways. High school, in one semester of college before I left for the Himalayas. But I was like a serious student, sitting on that rock all alone. I didn't talk to a person in about a month. There was nobody around. And I was praying for direction. Can I share with you just a few of the messages I received? I looked to my right and I saw Mother Ganga coming down from the high peaks of the Himalayas. And I was thinking, maybe it's a 1,000-mile journey from Gangotri to Ganga Sagara in the Bay of Bengal. And Mother Ganga, no matter what may come before her, keeps flowing to her destination. I was watching. I saw in those days there was huge, gigantic rocks on the banks of the Ganga here, and huge rocks in the Ganga. And Mother Ganga would just either flow over them or around them or under them. There was mountains, and somehow she always found her way around the mountain. And in doing so, she's teaching us that we should never give up on our journey to the sea of our true aspiration in life. Whatever obstacles, whatever challenges are just like rocks in the current of the Ganga. Somehow we must keep flowing in the direction where we want to go, to the sea of enlightenment, of divine love. And I gained such determination. I also saw in Mother Ganga, because it was a very, very rapid place and the waves were going very fast and it was so beautiful. I was thinking, just seeing her current is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. It's a work of art. But at every moment it's changing. It's never the same. It's always different water. It's always a different shape. And similarly, that's the way this world is. Nothing is stable. Everything is changing constantly. But the real beauty of life is through all these changes of the waves and the whirlpools, the underlying current of truth never changes. And if we can connect ourselves to the beauty of that truth, then we can be stable through all the unpredictable uncertainties of life. As I was sitting on the bank, I thought that this river has been flowing throughout our history. She was flowing here when Alexander the Great came to India, through the centuries of the Mughal Empire, through the British Empire, through all the changes after Indians' independence. Everything's changing around, but she just keeps flowing to the sea. In a similar way, in this world, despite all these changes, if we just attach ourselves to that flow of truth, which is eternal, then we'll find real peace. I hardly ate anything that month because I had no money. But every now and then, every day actually, as I was going back to the cave, there was this little old man who was selling carrots. And because he saw I was a sadhu, he would give me a little carrot every day. And Ganga water and carrot was my diet. But one day, someone gave me 1 rupee as I was walking. In those days, there was 7 rupees to a dollar. So 1 rupee was just a few cents. And I happened to see, not too far away, near that Chotiwala restaurant, in that area, there was a peanut seller. And I must confess to you, all my life I really liked peanuts. So I was thinking, when my fast ends at the end of the month, I'm going to buy a bag of peanuts and bring it back to my cave and have a feast. So I brought this rupee. I was expecting a bag maybe about 5 inches in size. When this peanut seller saw 1 rupee, his eyes lit up. And he got all these newspapers and made a huge grocery bag out of newspapers and filled it to the top with peanuts. They were fresh roasted in sand with their shells. And they were warm. And the smell of the peanuts were entering my nose. And I was thinking, oh, so nice. And I was carrying this big, probably about 1 kilo of peanuts. I was walking through the forest back to my cave. When suddenly, a brown monkey, a male monkey, he looked really big, like a customs agent. He blocked the path and stood right in front of me. And like a customs agent, he showed his fangs. And he didn't have the echo effects. And his green eyes were gazing at me with such anger. And even though I didn't know monkey language, I could tell he was saying, "Give me your peanuts." So suddenly, he just jumped at me and screamed. And as he jumped and screamed, he kicked my chest with his feet. His fangs were just inches from my nose. And he grabbed the bag and took them all away. Some of the peanuts fell to the ground. So I was thinking, at least something is here. But then these little baby monkeys came running out of the forest and picked up every peanut that fell. So I was left with nothing. And I was thinking, okay, what am I supposed to learn from this? And I got a wonderful lesson. As the Bible says, seek and you shall find. I was thinking that compared to the incredible wealth that I gained sitting on that rock, learning from Mother Ganga every day, all the wealth and power and prestige of this world is like peanuts. People lie and cry and die for these peanuts. But they do not recognize that at any moment, the monkey of another person's greed or the monkey of death is going to snatch all of our precious peanuts away. So why not pursue that which is eternal? That which is within us. That monkey is one of my gurus. After some time, I went to live on the mountain where Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's ashram was. At that time, it was so beautiful. Then I wandered down a little higher into the Himalayas, And somebody took me to bring to their guru, who lived in a cave. His name was Mahavir Das Tatwala Baba. His cave, there was carved steps in the mountain that led to his cave, because it was on a cliff. And he only wore a loincloth made of burlap. He would sit in a, usually either a Padmasan or a Siddhasan, and would meditate for hours or days at a time without moving. And he invited me to sit next to him and live with him. So I did for some time. And I meditated for some time, but every now and then I'd open my eyes and look around, and he would be fixed, unmoving. I remember looking down. In those days, sometimes I'd see wild elephants. I'd see cobras and pythons and snakes. I would sometimes see leopards, boars, lots of monkeys. And while I'd be sitting there with my little sadhu robes next to this yogi, I would remember where I was from, the suburbs of Chicago, and how it was flat with nice little roads and finely manicured lawns and gardens, and everybody had houses that kind of looked like every other house. And I was just kind of picturing in my mind's eye the children standing on the bus stop to get their bus to school, and the parents getting in their cars and driving to work. And here I was in the jungles, in a cave with a yogi, with all these wild animals. And I was so happy to be there. How different. How wonderful. One day this yogi told me that he was inviting me to remain there for the rest of my life with him. Now, I was just 19 years old, turning 20. He had long, long matted hair that when he sat down, it was several feet behind him on the ground. He was a powerful-looking man. And I was honored with his request. But I had to ask myself, am I ready to stay here for the rest of my life? Is this my guru? Is this my path? I didn't know. I wanted to travel more. But how to explain that to someone like this, who didn't speak English? But every now and then a Nepalese man would translate for us. And one day I decided to tell him that I was going to go. And I was kind of afraid, because he had supernatural powers. What if he was offended? So I said a little prayer to God that please make him understand. And just when I was about to open my mouth, he spoke the exact words I was about to tell him. And he smiled, just a very little smile, and put out his hand to bless me and said, "Follow your heart. Goodbye. May God bless you." So I left and started traveling north to the higher Himalayas. And the next day, I was trapped in a leprosy colony. And one old, dying leper woman showed such motherly love upon me that it completely transformed the whole way I was seeing the world. You could read the book if you want to hear the story. Then I traveled north and came to Dev Prayag, where the Alaknanda River is flowing down, meeting the Bhagirath River, and where the two rivers have their sangam, they converge. From that point, we call it in this world the Ganges. I went really early in the morning to take my bath, and it was dark, so I didn't see how fast the current was. In those days, nobody could just bathe there. You had to hold on to chains to bathe there. So I went in the water and I was swept away. All of a sudden, and within seconds, I felt this grip on my arm, and that grip pulled me out of the water, picked me up, and threw me on the riverbank. And there was this gigantic mountain-like sadhu who had done this. And he put his hand on my head and started chanting mantras for my protection. His name was Kailash Baba. And he took me in just like a father takes his son, because he saw I was obviously very inexperienced about living in the jungles of the Himalayas. He looked like he was in his late 60s. But as I traveled around with him, I met one yogi who was very old. And he spoke English. He told me that as far as he's known Kailash Baba for like 50 years. And he said, he was as old as you see him even then. He said, as far as I'm concerned, he's a couple hundred years old. And he said, back then I saw Kailash Baba perform supernatural powers. He was doing all kinds of miracles. He has cities. And people started worshiping him and honoring him because of what he could do. And Kailash Baba took a vow. I will never ever demonstrate these powers. This man said people were willing to throw money on him. He could have opened temples, ashrams, everything. But Kailash Baba chose to just remain completely unknown, homeless, wandering through the jungles. Kailash Baba taught me how to live in the forest, how to eat. These are kind of details that sometimes we have to address in our lives. If you have no money and you're living in a jungle, how do you eat? He taught me which roots and which herbs you can eat, which were medicinal, which were poisonous. He taught me how to find little things from trees that you just see every day, but you don't know. They're actually food. He taught me how to beg. Because when we would come to little villages or little holy towns, he would sometimes beg. And people give you the cheapest food when you beg, usually chipped rice. Boa. But he taught me that contrary to the West, where a beggar is seen as like a parasite, when holy people beg, it is one of the most esteemed, exalted positions, that you've given up everything in pursuit of truth. And you don't go to beg from people to get food. You go there in the role of a beggar to beg them to receive God's blessings. Through associating with a yogi, they will be blessed. by giving to a servant of God, they will be blessed. He taught me that begging was something that we could feel very deep enrichment. But he taught me something else that was probably his best lesson. How to live in harmony with our neighbors. Because we would just sleep on the ground, under trees, in caves, on riverbanks. And there were all sorts of snakes, vipers, cobras. There were leopards and panthers and wild elephants and wild boars. And mosquitoes and monkeys. He taught me that if you think that you are superior to these animals, or if you have the slightest fear of them, they will kill you. And you have no defense against them. He taught that we must see how we are all related. Not judge living beings by the type of body they have, but to see what we have in common. The Atma is the living force that gives consciousness and life to all beings. And that Atma is a part of God, who later I learned to call Krishna. Aham Bija Prathapita. That one supreme absolute truth is the father and mother of all living beings. There's a verse in the Gita that I later learned. Vidyavanaya sampane brahmani kavihastini suni chaiva swapake cha pandita samadarshana. What is the definition in the Gita of wisdom? It's the ability to see every living being with equal vision. Whether one is of one religion or another, of one species or another, of one race, of one sex, wherever there's life, life is sacred. Wherever there's life, there's a child of God. And if we understand our own relationship with God, we will understand our internal, eternal relationship with every living being. And there will be no fear. Honor and respect all these animals and reptiles and insects as God's children. And have no fear of them. Have faith in God. And they will never harm you, he promised. But if you fear, or if you think being a human you are superior, you're on their property. They will kill you. Now, sometimes when you learn things in school, you have some time to study before the test. But it wasn't like that. He was telling me, and all these different kinds of animal and insect and reptile people were all around. But something very wonderful was there. Because Kailash Baba actually had no fear, and because I could see how he honored, respect, and loved every one of these creatures, he was in that state he was talking about. And just by being near him, I could also, in my own way, see them as my brothers and sisters, to honor them and to have no fear. That's the power of being with saintly people. Not only do they give us wisdom, but in their association, they actually give us the realization to live by that wisdom. One of the most difficult things he taught me. This is interesting. How to get along peacefully with other sadhus. That was much more complicated than leopards, cobras, scorpions, and panthers. Because everyone has their own ideas and their own ideologies and their own gurus and everything like this. And everyone has their own customs. But he taught me how to actually live in respect and honor and harmony with different types of sadhus. He was like a father, and he treated me just like a son as we roamed through the jungles together. And it was cold. And all I had was two pieces of cotton cloth to cover my body. But he had a wool blanket. So when we would lay down in the forest or on a cliff or on a riverbank, he would always give me his blanket. And I would never accept it. How can I take your blanket and then you don't have a blanket? And he said, no, you take me. He didn't say it. He would just give me the blanket and then I would give it back to him and he would give it to me and I would give it back to him and he would give it to me. And I don't know what I'm saying, if it makes sense, but it ended up that we would both lay under the blanket together every night. After some time, I realized that my journey, it was time for me to move on. And I also felt that his life was one of seclusion, and I was imposing myself upon him. And out of compassion, he was letting me be with him. So I bowed down to say goodbye. And he embraced me. He was a gigantic person. He embraced me like a bear. And there were tears in his eyes. And he blessed me. And I turned around. And as I was walking around away, I was thinking that on this path I'm meeting some of the greatest, most beautiful people I ever met in my life. And as wandering mendicants, when we leave each other, we know we may never see each other again. But that was the life of a sadhu. And I was walking away thinking that my feelings of separation from him will always keep his presence in my heart. Now I'm going to tell you something that may not make sense to you. Kailash Baba taught me more than anybody I've ever met up until that time. But he did not speak a word of English. And I didn't speak a word of Hindi. I knew a few words like acha or tora tora or something like that. How is it that I learned so much from him? Because he deeply cared about me. He really wanted to bring me closer to God. And I was so eager to receive that knowledge. And when a teacher really cares, and when a student is eager to learn, something mystical happens. There's a transference of knowledge and information that comes through grace, through a spiritual frequency. Just by pointing his finger or speaking a language I didn't know or raising his eyebrows, he gave me so many messages. Should Can I continue? In Dehradun, I lived with Anandamayi Ma for some time, and then went higher to Uttarkashi. And there I found a nice cave there. And I learned how to really be able to calculate different kinds of caves. There were 5-star caves, 4-star caves, 1-star caves. But it really didn't make any difference. I was in Uttarkashi, and after living in a cave for some time, I came down to the village. I was just meditating up there and just contemplating, reading some holy books. When I came down to the village, there was a group of sadhus in this little ashram. They were offering some free prasad. So I was there. And one yogi came out of the forest. And he spoke very boldly. He said, "I challenge, bring all the doctors and scientists of this area to meet me at 12 o'clock noon." Or I think he said 6 o'clock in the evening, that was it, something like that. He gave a specific time. He said, "I will challenge them." So about a dozen doctors came. They were all sitting in this little ashram, and this yogi comes back out of the forest. And he said, "I want to show you the power of yoga. You are so much running and running and running to all your materialistic sciences that you've forgotten the incredible heritage of your own culture. Before your eyes, I will die. And you test me with all your instruments. And in exactly 30 minutes, I will come back to life to show you the power of yoga." Doctors were watching. He sat in a Padmasana and began to inhale and exhale. Bastrika Pranayam. He was very, very forcefully for about 2 minutes. And then he inhaled and sat completely motionless. And the doctors, stethoscopes, pulse, he was dead. There was no heartbeat, no breath, no pulse. Even I went and borrowed a stethoscope and was like putting it over his heart and listening. And exactly 30 minutes later, to the second, he exhaled, stood up, and walked back into the forest. I was thinking that was a good show. I met another yogi. His name was Bal Shiva Yogi. And he was a very, very different kind of sadhu. I traveled in the forest with him for some time. He loved to eat sweets. I never met a sadhu like that. We'd go out begging, and he would insist that people gave him sweets, like laddus and peta and all these different things. And he was very restless. But when it came to his spiritual practice, it was intense. So one day, I was about to leave, and he said, "Stay one more day, I want to take you somewhere." And he was giving a satsang in this hall. We came to a village. It was already scheduled, I don't know how. And there was about 100 people that came. And he opened his hand, and chanted a mantra. And he closed his hand. And then he opened his hand, and a Shivalinga came out of his hand. And he put it down on this table. And then he closed, just opened his hand again and closed his hand and chanted a mantra. And ashes started pouring out of the palm of his hand, falling on the Shivalingam until the whole Shivalingam was covered with ashes. And the people came up to worship him and honor him as God. And he stopped them. He said, "Don't be fooled. Don't worship me." He said, "This is not spiritual what I'm doing. It's just a material scientific way of manipulating subtle energy, manipulating the gross material energy through subtle energies." He said, "If you don't know how to do it, it seems like a miracle. But through yoga process, you just learn how to do it. It's not that somebody like me is God or great because we do these things. We just know how to do it." He said, "Real spiritual enlightenment is to go beyond the body, beyond the ego, beyond selfishness, beyond the desire for prestige, and realize our eternal soul, and to realize our relation with God." And those were his last words. Then he turned to me. He came off the stage and said, "Did you like what I did?" And I said, "Yeah, that was nice." I especially liked, you know, that you were humble about it all. And then he smiled and opened his hand and closed it and chanted a mantra and gave me a rudra. He looked so powerful, but so humble. He walked with such grace, but with such, and such, he really deeply affected my heart, but he was a distance away, and I was wishing I could be closer. And there were some people singing kirtan on the stage, and he called one man over, and he said something in his ear. I could see it way, way, way over. And that person was motioning for someone to come. But no, Trabeach, covered with ashes. And then I left him and went back into the forest again. And I remember sitting under a banyan tree and just meditating on what I had just saw. He said to those people that I'm not God. God creates, he said, I can create ashes. God creates universes. That's the difference. And I was meditating on those words that he spoke. And I saw a little banyan tree seed. And I was thinking, everywhere we go, we see miracles. The whole creation is nothing but incredible supernatural miracles. But because we're so accustomed to see it, we don't even recognize it. In this little seed is a massive banyan tree. Nobody could do that. How is that possible? God puts a tree in a seed this big. When a man and woman come together, they don't even know what's happening. And a little seed goes into the woman's ovum, and it emulsifies, and soon little eyes come, and little ears come, and a tongue comes, and a brain comes, and kidneys, and hearts, and lungs, and pancreas. And it's not that the husband or wife have some engineering master plan. It's just happening. And then then a human is born. Or a calf. It's incredible. If a human could walk up walls, it would consider be a miracle. But every day we see spiders and flies walking up walls, and we just, okay, you know, walking up walls. If a human could fly, we'd think that's a miracle. But every bird, they don't have to take aviation lessons. They just fly. Their mother doesn't even teach them to fly. They just know how to fly. And fish, they could live their whole life underwater. There's so many miracles everywhere. I looked up at the cloud in the sky. There was a big cloud. And I was thinking, well, now I'm going to go fast forward in Bombay during the monsoon season. At least once a year, there's a cloud that forms that totally floods the whole city. The airports are closed. The railway system is closed. The streets are like little rivers. No cars could move. Everything is at a standstill because of the water contained in one cloud. But before the rain, the cloud is just floating in the sky. There's trillions and trillions and trillions of liters and gallons of water in that cloud, but it's just floating. And a little breeze comes and moves it. That's a miracle. We're seeing it every day. In every tree, in every person, in every living being, in every cloud. The sun. What a miracle is the sun. It's giving so much heat and so much light. And it's not like there's a pipeline coming from Saudi Arabia. Where's it getting its energy? It's not getting smaller. For billions of years, it's just shining light and heat. Miracles everywhere. These are the miracles of God. Yogeshwar. I met many different Himalayan yogis. And just from Mother Ganga in the Himalayas and everything and everyone in the Himalayas, I was learning so much. I remember sitting somewhere on my way to Badrinath. There was a little temple made out of stone, and some simple people were just there ringing some bells and doing some worship. And I was just sitting there watching. And after the service, I saw these bumblebees. They were going from flower to flower to flower to flower. I was just watching their wings. You can't even see how fast they're going. Incredible aviation. And I was kind of thinking, I'm like that bumblebee. I'm just going place to place to place, seeking some nectar, seeking some knowledge, seeking some wisdom. Then I heard a baby cry, crying for its mother. And I remember thinking, when will I be able to cry for my beloved Lord with the same sincerity as this baby? Sharanagati, feeling completely dependent on the grace of my beloved. Then I will understand my beloved, when I could be like that baby. A little later, I was traveling to Varanasi, to Bodh Gaya, to Calcutta, and I was in Mumbai. And I was taking a course on Buddhist meditation. And after 10 days of just sitting and meditating all day, every day, I decided the course was over, I was going to take a walk. And I didn't have any shoes, but I was just walking and walking for miles. I didn't know where I was going, I didn't know what direction, but I just walked. And then I saw this giant sign that advertised a spiritual festival at a park called Cross Maidan. So I went there. And when I arrived, there was just a few people there, but they told me that a guru was going to speak at night. So I stayed. And when night came, there was about 25,000 people sitting on the ground in that park. And the guru came to the stage. And I was way in the back. And I was shy. I still am, even though I pretend I'm not. But I was very shy to go in front of anyone else. So I was way, way in the back. And when he came on the stage, he looked so pop, but he walked. Really deeply affected, but he was in his ear, I could see it. To come, but nobody came. So that person came down and was walking through all the crowds and crowds and crowds of people all the way to the back and walked right up to me and said, "My guru, Srila Prabhupada, wants you to sit with him on the stage." And I said, "How does he know me?" He never answered my question. He just grabbed my hand and pulled me. And in those days, I was very pullable. He just pulled me through the crowds of tens and thousands of people and brought me right up to the stage and brought me to the guru. And the guru very lovingly, graciously welcomed me and had me sit close to him. And he spoke. First he sang a beautiful kirtan, and then he spoke. And what I remember hearing from his talk and seeing through him is he was talking about bhakti, the yoga of love and devotion. And it was beginning to awaken within me what would ultimately become the path that I gave my life for. Love is the highest realization. It is said that if you water the root of the tree, the water naturally goes to every leaf, branch, fruit, and flower. Similarly, when we awaken the dormant love within our hearts for God, who he called Krishna, the all-attractive, all-loving, all-beautiful, in the concept of Krishna, the power and majesty of God goes into the background, and his sweetness, his love, his beauty attracts our heart to love. And when we open our hearts to love, then we could actually access and experience the infinite love of God for each and every one of us. And this is just so beautiful. It transformed me. And he taught that the simplest, most powerful way of awakening this love and compassion is through mantra meditation, chanting the sweet names of the Lord. Hadarnama, Hadarnama, Hadarnam, Eva Kevalam, Kalona, Stevana, Stevana, Steva Gatiranyata. Kali, Kale, Namarupe, Krishnavatar. Quoted from the scriptures that Krishna or God incarnates in this age of Kali in the sweet sound of the name. Nam namakari bahudat nija saravashaktis. They're all the powers, the beauty of God is within the name of Krishna. And there are many names according to how that one supreme truth has descended into this world many times throughout history. In all these names have the power to clean our hearts of egoism, selfishness, greed, envy, anger, and awaken compassion, devotion, and love. What I learned from the great sages of the Himalayas in my life culminated in this experience. And at this time, with your permission, I'd like to invite you to chant in kirtan. Should I teach you a special asana? We call this the Sharanagati asana. Everyone, please stand up. As I am chanting with folded hands like this, everyone, please. We say namaskar, which means I offer my homage, my honor, and my love to the divinity within you. That's how we greet each other. In this sense, as I am chanting in kirtan, the holy names, welcome Krishna, welcome Sri Radha into your hearts with a grateful state of mind, through your ears, through your mind, to your very soul. In other words, with a grateful heart, be fully fixed in concentration, meditation on this sound vibration. And in response, all of you chant. And as you're chanting, raise your arms like this. Everyone, please. This is a tradition that has been for many, many centuries, millenniums. When we call out like a child reaching out for the blessings of one's mother, we call out Krishna's names. By raising our arms, this is an act of humility. Krishna, I'm yours. Like an antenna, our arms are going out to receive the grace of God and to also emit that grace to fill the universe. And also you could move your legs from the left foot in front of right and right foot in front of left, and in this way, dance.